From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Gloria Steinem has written a new book about self-esteem. It was supposed to be about problems other women had, but it ended up addressing Steinem's own problems with romance, food, and burnout. We'll talk with her on today's Fresh Air. Also today, a leading man who is more often the leading lady. We meet actor Everett Quinton. He became the director of the Ridiculous Theatrical Company after the death of its founder, Charles Ludlam. Book critic John Leonard reviews the new collection of stories from Russian writer Tatiana Tolstoya. And rock historian Ed Ward goes back 10 years to 1982. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The Algerian government today arrested the leader of the Muslim Islamic Salvation Front and banned all public gatherings outside mosques. The action is intended to break up the Muslim fundamentalist group, which was expected to take power in elections that were scrapped by the new military-backed government. The Islamic Front said that its acting president, Abdelkader Hachani, was arrested today for telling members of the military to revolt. The official Algerian news agency also said that several journalists were arrested at the independent Daily El Kabar, an Arab-language paper that had printed two Islamic Front communiques. Israeli authorities have arrested 60 Palestinians suspected of being activists in the Palestinian uprising, NPR's Linda Gradstein reports.
The pre-dawn arrest sweep was a joint operation by the Army, police, and Secret Service. The troops placed a curfew on the West Bank city of Ramallah and arrested 60 activists in Ramallah, Nablus, and East Jerusalem. Carrying lists of wanted Palestinians, they carried out house-to-house searches. Most of the Palestinians are alleged activists in radical factions. Security authorities said the goal of the operation was to destroy the infrastructure of guerrilla cells that have recently increased armed attacks on Jewish settlers, killing four in the past 3 months. Earlier this week, Defense Minister Moshe Arens announced Israel would increase the number of soldiers serving in the territories by 20%. Israeli peace groups charge that both today's arrests and the increase in troops is a government attempt to appease Jewish settlers. I'm Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
Dow Corning today agreed to release 90 documents about the safety of silicone breast implants. The documents chronicle the company's controversial response to safety questions. The Food and Drug Administration had pressured the company into making these documents public. NPR's Richard Harris has the story.
The FDA called for a voluntary moratorium on silicone breast implants earlier this month. And one reason was that the FDA discovered some internal Dow Corning memos that raised concerns about the company's safety research on these implants. Some of these memos have been seen by juries, and some have been leaked to the press. And according to one interpretation, the memos show that Dow Corning knew there might be problems with the implants, but didn't investigate aggressively. Company officials hope that the public will develop a different impression about these memos once they are annotated with a point-by-point company response. Dow Corning today said it was preparing that response and would release the annotated memos in a few weeks. This is Richard Harris in Washington.
President Bush today said he will ask Congress for $600 million in new aid for the Commonwealth of Independent States. The United States is hosting an international conference of 47 nations who are discussing strategies to help the former Soviet Union. The republics are asking for food, medicine, and other assistance. Stocks closed higher on Wall Street today. The Dow advanced 32 points to wind up at 3255.81. This is NPR. The Federal Reserve today released a grim report on the nation's economy. The report found that the American economy shows little sign of life anywhere. The Fed found that business executives believe that the recession will improve, but there is little firm evidence on which to base their hopes and expectations. Dr. Jack Kevorkian, the inventor of the so-called suicide machine, has published an essay in a leading psychiatric journal calling for the establishment of a network of doctors trained to assist people who wish to kill themselves. Don Gagne reports.
Dr. Kevorkian, writing in the February issue of the American Journal of Forensic Psychiatry, proposes that the nation be divided into zones, each containing a panel of doctors specializing in suicide. These physicians, called obituarists, would take referrals from the personal physicians of people interested in committing suicide. They would then decide if such requests should be granted. The article has drawn harsh criticism from the medical community. Over the past 18 months, Dr. Kevorkian has helped three women commit suicide in Michigan. In each case, they used drug delivery devices provided by the 63-year-old retired pathologist. Currently, prosecutors in suburban Detroit are considering whether to charge Kevorkian with murder in the two most recent suicides, which took place last October. A state board has already suspended his medical license. For National Public Radio, this is Don Gagne in Detroit.
Anti-abortion activists today marched on the National Mall in Washington, D.C. They were marking the 19th anniversary of the Supreme Court's decision legalizing abortion. Police authorities estimate that as many as 70,000 people participated. President Bush today filled the last vacancy in his cabinet by nominating Andrew Card for the position of Transportation Secretary. Card, a former Republican legislator in Massachusetts, managed the president's campaign in New Hampshire 4 years ago. The favorite person for the post had been Carol Hallett, the current Customs Commissioner. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Gloria Steinem is not only a tireless leader of the feminist movement and co-founder of Ms. Magazine, but in the mainstream press, her name has been almost synonymous with feminism. After years of writing about the political, social, and economic barriers to women's rights, Gloria Steinem has now written about one of the inner barriers that holds many women back, low self-esteem. Her new book, Revolution from Within, was first inspired by the kind of women she so often met on the road, women who were smart and courageous, yet very insecure, the kind of women who, in spite of their accomplishments, would preface their opinions with phrases like, "I don't know, maybe it's only me, but..." Steinem then began reading the many self-help books for women. She was disappointed to find they dealt only with internal change, without addressing the need for a social revolution. So she began writing her own book.
I sat down and wrote, you know, some 200-300 pages of repertorial philosophical prose and showed it to a friend who said, you know, "I don't know how to tell you this, but you have a self-esteem problem. You forgot to put yourself in." Before I began to even get a glimmer of realizing that I was, of course, as we so often do, writing what we need to read and teaching what we need to learn, and that, in fact, a lot of pressures had come to a focus at the same point in my life, the loss of Ms. Magazine, just the of course, it's back again now, but I mean, you know, I'm talking about 1987, the sheer tiredness of 20 years of being flat-out activist in a kind of unbalanced way, and the realization that I was repeating in adulthood a pattern of neglect. I know that sounds corny. I don't know how else to say it, but, you know, you do go on treating yourself often as you were treated as a child, but I just hadn't realized that. You know, if I didn't take care of myself or choose to own very much or save money, I thought it was a conscious decision, and it took me some real crises to understand that I was treating myself the way I had been treated in childhood. It just all came together at the time that I realized I'd written the wrong book. And so the book became a very personal journey. It's only about 20% personal, I suppose, but still a very personal journey as well as a repertorial one.
Do you think that what you had been lacking was time for a personal life or self-esteem? They're two different things that might be related, but they're basically different.
Well, I think if you have a strong sense of what I would call core self-esteem, you take time for yourself and you draw limits and you realize you need sustenance. And I had a picture of myself as two things: one, less real than other people, because which is very typical of neglected children. This wasn't my parents' fault. They were doing the best they could, but still, you know, I had not gone to school and, you know, many other things when I was growing up. And also I'd taken care of my mother, who was an invalid much of the time. So I thought of myself as a caretaker. You know, I was not the one with problems. I was the one who helped other people. And that was just so entrenched that I couldn't think of myself any other way and take time for myself.
You said that you felt less real than other people. I'm wondering if you felt that your sense of who you were and your sense of self-esteem was different in your professional life than in your personal life. If you had more faith in yourself as, like, Gloria Steinem, feminist, than as Gloria Steinem, you know, a person at home.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think that's sort of the same thing, really, because the form it takes is that you believe your inner life is not as real as the outer world, and therefore you make yourself real by being useful. And, you know, it's the source of workaholism, classically. Now, it happened that I was lucky to be part of a movement that gave me life and that was connected to my life. It wasn't as if I was making widgets, you know. I care and continue to care deeply about what I was doing. But I was just, I had got totally out of balance. So that the internal, you know, it isn't, I think, that our internal life is more or less real. It's that it's as real as the external life. And I just was nowhere near close to realizing that.
You don't want us to read your book as Gloria Steinem recants her dedication to the women's movement.
Oh, heavens
no. She realizes she would have been better off with a traditional life.
Oh, my goodness, no. I mean, I would have been, you know, totally, no, the movement gave me life and continues to give me life. It's absolutely not. And I'm very grateful and very happy for very much of what I was able to be part of. On the contrary, the thing is, I think I would have been a more effective activist if I'd had a better grounding in childhood or been able to go back and figure out why I didn't have a better grounding, because it made me, for instance, very, very scared of conflict, likely to confuse motion with action, you know, just to keep going for the sake of going. It made me a less effective activist, and I hope and believe that when we look inward and strengthen ourselves, we get more effective on the outside.
Are there things that you feel women friends of yours have or have had that you now wish you had as well?
For instance?
Well, personal life type of things, marriage, children.
Oh no. Mm-mm. No, because I mean... Not in those forms. I mean, if you said to me, did I miss having a home? Yes, I did miss having a home. But
you mean physically a home?
Physically a home, because a home is a kind of symbol of the self. And I think a lot of single women felt somewhere inside, I guess, that you were not supposed to make a home except unless you were making it for other people. And also, it was redoubled for me because I hadn't had a home when I was a child, so I didn't know how to do it. But I think the inner life and home and love and closeness and intimacy, we all need those things, but we all need them in particular and very different ways. I mean, I had, thanks to the movement, been able to find chosen family, that is, people who shared values, mostly other women, you know, but some men too, who became literally family because of the intensity of the work that we were doing together. And that was a great gift.
I ask about, you know, if you changed your mind about mm-hmm. marriage and children, because I think that for women a little younger than you, there are so few women to look around at and say, well, how do they feel? They've made mm-hmm. the decision to either be single or to not have children, you know, as they get older, do they still think it was a good choice, or do they regret it? What's ahead when you look down the line? So that's why I'm asking you that.
No, I understand that, and I, you know, we're all looking at each other's lives,
right,
trying to figure out
exactly
how to live. And all I can say is that it's I feel great joy in this path that I've chosen. I mean, we don't have to give birth to someone to nurture them. And I'm happy with those choices.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Gloria Steinem. She's written a new book called Revolution from Within, a book of self-esteem. You were diagnosed with breast cancer in 1986. You had a lumpectomy, and that really did the trick. It never came back, thank goodness.
Yeah, so far I'm fine, and I have mixed feelings about. I always feel I have to explain my experience with breast cancer because so many other women have had so much more horrendous experiences than I have.
Yeah.
And yet, when the word cancer comes into your life in whatever form, it really does have a great impact. And it was very, important to me, you know, because it made me realize several things. One was, this may sound strange if I try to say it short, but that actually I was less afraid of dying than of aging, or not of aging exactly. I didn't know how to enter the last third of life because there were so few role models. Because when I first heard this diagnosis, I thought, ironically, oh, so that's how it's going to end, you know. And then I thought to myself, as if it was welling up from the deepest part of me, I've had a wonderful life. And I treasure that moment, you know, it meant a lot to me. But on the other hand, it also made me realize that in this culture, women, we know how to be in the central plateau of life. And I'd been there a terrifically long time because I'd become a grown-up too early because my mother being an invalid. So from about 10 to 52 or so, I'd been in this central plateau. Now I was entering a whole new place. It was like falling off a cliff because I couldn't see enough people ahead of me. You know, in the last two or three years of really, how shall I say, of kind of paying more attention to my own inner life, I've realized that this aging in the last third of life or whatever is a new country. I now actually feel excited about it because you, as Carolyn Heilbrun has pointed out so brilliantly in Writing a Woman's Life, women become ourselves after 50. You know, we leave behind this female impersonator role and drop a lot of baggage and really become much more our true selves.
You know what I find particularly interesting about hearing you thinking about the latter part of your life is that I think for a lot of women, it's the end of your life where you're supposed to be punished for the freedoms that you've taken during the first parts of your life. You know, like if you've decided to be independent or, you know, not be married or not have children or something, you're punished for that in the end because you're supposed to look forward to an old age where you're lonely, you're alone, there's no one to be with, no one to take care of you. I mean, I think that's been really instilled in all of
mm-hmm,
us.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it's sort of the secular version of hell, I think. and like the religious version of hell, it has nothing to do with real life.
Uh-huh.
I mean, you know, that's always been clearly to me part of the backlash. You know, I just don't believe that. I mean, it you know, if you've done the best you can. I mean, what's so wonderful about being dependent in the last third of life when you're a grown-up when it was difficult enough when you were a child? You know, and I just think we need to think about what we want to do. It's suddenly ideas of dependency and being taken care of re-enter our heads because that's the only model for old age we have. But we're inventing new models. I remember that Tish Summers, the late Tish Summers, you know, had a wonderful group called the Last Perch, which were older women, each of whom you know, was part of a community and a kind of chosen family to grow old together. You know, and I love the name anyway, The Last Perch. I thought that was
great. Yeah,
yeah. You know, we need to let our imaginations roam in new ways. Probably we are on the edge of history. This may be the first time that there has been a very big age cohort, as the sociologists say, of women who have a tradition of independence and who are living longer. And since women grow more radical with age, as we know, our pattern of activism is the reverse of men's. I don't mean all men and all women, of course. I'm sure listeners understand that. But in general, because women lose power as they get older and men gain power, then the activism goes in the other direction. So I have this vision of an army of gray-haired women taking over the earth. You know, this may become the kind of red-hot center of feminist revolution precisely because there are more women with greater tradition of independence and greater in number and living longer who can take advantage of this fact of growing more radical with age.
An interesting vision. My guest is Gloria Steinem. She's written a new book called Revolution from Within, a Book of Self-Esteem. We're going to take a short break, then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air.
Gloria Steinem is my guest. In your new book, in the parts that are personal, you write a little bit about a relationship that you had in the 80s that didn't work out. You don't mention the name of the book, but I think a lot of people already know that it was with the real estate developer.
No, I don't think they do know.
Oh.
Because I have never indicated who it was, and if I'd wanted people to know who it was, I would have written. There are two stories in that chapter, and I don't say who either one of them are.
Okay, it's been mentioned in magazines, but you still...
But that's their problem.
All right. Mm-hmm. as you write in the book, you fell in love with someone who you felt was obviously wrong for you. And you read in the book that you relied on your skill of getting a man to fall in love with you, but you got him to fall in love with the inauthentic you,
mm-hmm.
so you had to keep on not being yourself mm-hmm. in order to keep the relationship going. And I was really wondering, what were the parts of your personality that rose to the surface that you saw as not being yourself during this relationship?
That's a good question, because it's sort of hard to identify. I think it was really just resting in a way, you know, not feeling that I had to be a caretaker. I mean, I felt at last here was somebody who was so strong that I didn't have to take care of him, and it was at a moment in which I felt I was taking care of the earth, you know. What I didn't realize was that I was looking for I was missing strength in myself. I'd allowed myself to become very weakened, so I was projecting onto him or looking to him for what I needed myself. And so I let go by all kinds of differences in values, which normally I would have understood was a problem for any friendship.
The person who you were in a relationship with was very, very wealthy and had a lot of business interests, and I was wondering if that relationship caused anyone close to you or anyone who just knew you from your books and from your kind of public work, if it made them question your politics because of your affiliation with him. And if so, what your reaction to that was?
Yeah, I think it did. It probably made them question my you know, I mean, nobody understood it, right? It made me defiant. Do you know what I mean? You know how it is when somebody questions one a choice of yours, sometimes it makes you all the more determined,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I think it had that impact on me for a while.
And I've read that you're not in a relationship now for the first time since you were 21, is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, right. It shows you what a 50s person I am, even though.
Well, what do you like and not like about being single now? Or, you know, being not in a relationship?
Uh-huh. Well, I haven't come to the point yet where I find something that I don't like about it, which means that it's still a choice. You know, I may come to the point at which I find something, but right now I feel like I'm doing something that I should have done when I was a teenager or in my 20s, or you know, because there's a kind of a joy and a freedom that comes from making your own schedule, not worrying about somebody else's friends, not having to apologize because you have a deadline and you have to cancel something. It doesn't mean that I haven't in the past taken great pleasure and learned a great deal from the people I've been close to and loved. It's just that I'm experiencing a different kind of pleasure now.
In your book, Revolution from Within, you write a little bit about your own self-image. And in the book, you describe yourself as a foodaholic. And you say your father was 300 pounds. And you write, "I'm not a thin woman. I'm a fat woman who's not fat at the moment."
Mm-hmm, right.
Do you see yourself as having an eating disorder?
Well, you know, that's such a label now. It's hard to know. I think we're all, given the culture and what it does to our pictures of women's bodies, the eating disorders are a continuum. You know, I was never bulimic in the sense of vomiting and so on. I would never do that, nor was I ever anorexic in any way. But I was enough addicted to food so that I couldn't keep food in my house, and I was especially addicted to sugar and so on. So, you know, it's a continuum. And if you feel a kind of emptiness inside, you try, or if you feel unacceptable emotions welling up, anger and things that women aren't supposed to experience, you stuff it down with food. You know, this is certainly the understanding of women who have come forth and helped each other in eating disorder groups.
Well, I think it's interesting for you as a feminist to say to other women that your thinness, which so many women admire and envy, comes out of something that you see as a problem.
Mm-hmm. No, I think it's important to say that. You know, the book was published in England first, so I went there first, and it was real hard to talk about all this in the land of the stiff upper lip, you know. So I'm glad to be talking to you. But one woman actually said to me, well, as a leader, whatever that means, I mean, I would object to that, but anyway, of the women's movement, aren't you betraying other women by talking about your, you know, inner problems and processes and so on? And I didn't know what to say to her. Finally, I said, well, in that case, all leaders should betray us, you know, because because unless, you know, what it doesn't do us any good, you know, to think that somebody else is another species and doesn't share the same experiences. In fact, I put Gandhi in this book as a personal story, a personal parable of his growing up and childhood and, you know, the first half of his life, because I think seeing him as the saint he's portrayed doesn't help us. But because I lived in India, I got to realize that he had spent the first half of his life as this, you know, very, very insecure, you know, imitative, conformist person who you know, went to England to be trained as a barrister and wore pinstripe suits and wing collars and tried desperately to learn how to foxtrot and play the violin and speak French and so on, until he finally realized that the bias against Indians on the part of the British in South Africa, in his case, was so complete that no amount of conformism to his false self was going to get him anywhere. He might as well be his true self. And that became his strength. Now, that makes me much better able to learn from him than I ever was before. I love the idea that he was once this gawky guy, you know, in a pinstripe suit trying to foxtrot.
In trying to find more time for your private life, for yourself, what have you given up in terms of your more public life?
Well, I'm just beginning this book tour now, and I think maybe what I've given up is a certain amount of ability to function on automatic pilot. Do you know what I mean? It's like I feel I now have more nerve endings than I did. I feel more. That means you feel both more pain and more joy, or, you know, to be corny about it, but it's true, you know. So I may not be able to get back into that automatic pilot mode. I'm not sorry that I can't, if you know what I mean. I mean, mm-hmm. I think it's progress, but it does mean you have to think differently and schedule yourself differently.
Well, good luck on the road.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
My guest has been Gloria Steinem, and she's written a new book called Revolution from Within, A Book of Self-Esteem. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air.
Everett Quinton says even as a kid, he knew he was a drag queen, but he didn't know he was going to be performing in drag in front of an audience and winning critical acclaim for it in the New York Times. Coming up, Everett Quinton on directing the ridiculous theatrical company in Manhattan. Tatiana Tolstoya is the great-grandniece of Russian writer Leo Tolstoy. John Leonard has a review of Tolstoya's new collection of short stories. And rock historian Ed Ward concludes his series on the past four decades with a survey of the music that was popular 10 years ago. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Bush wants to send another $645 million in aid to the people of the former Soviet Union because he says they will need help this year. Barry Schwide reports.
President Bush made the pledge at a 47-nation conference. It wasn't supposed to be a bidding contest, but the president kicked it off with a promise of $645 million in grants. That means gifts that don't have to be repaid. It came as a bit of a surprise. The president and Secretary of State James Baker have been stressing self-help and restricting most of the U.S. support, which totaled more than $4 billion, to credits to buy food. Those credits have to be repaid. Polls showed many Americans feel the U.S. was doing more than enough already. And running for re-election, the president has the recession to bear in mind. But he said the people in the 11 new republics need a helping hand, or, as Secretary of State Baker called it in his own speech, a measure of hope. For National Public Radio, this is Barry Schwide at the State Department.
The federal government says that housing starts were down nearly 15% last year to their lowest point in 46 years. The Commerce Department says that housing starts were off in every part of the nation. While new construction did improve toward the end of last year, it was centered on single-family units. And multifamily housing starts were down in both November and December. In Algeria, the provisional leader of the nation's main religious party, Abdelkader Hishani, has been arrested as the nation's new military-backed government clamps down on the Islamic Salvation Front. Jackie Rowland reports from Algiers.
Hishani's arrest was widely expected. He has provided a strong leadership for the Islamic Salvation Front over the past 6 months, and the authorities knew he was a crucial figure in the party's structure. Hishani was picked up by police a few hours ago in a fundamentalist stronghold on the outskirts of Algiers, where he had been lying low for several days. Many hundreds of the party's supporters are reported to have been arrested since Friday, when heavily armed troops cordoned off a mosque where Hishani was speaking. The party has yet to react to its leader's arrest, but Hishani has already indicated there could be protests. In an interview carried out a few hours before his arrest, he said Islamic militants would not stand by idly if the authorities tried to dissolve the party. For National Public Radio, this is Jackie Rowland in Algiers.
According to news reports from Portugal, five boys were killed in a fireworks factory explosion. Officials say the youngsters sneaked into a factory at night looking for carnival firecrackers and then caused an explosion by lighting a match in a dark storage shed. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up over 32 points to close at 3,255. This is NPR News. French television is reporting that crews on board Airbus A320s twice reported faulty navigational information. An Airbus 320 crashed this week, killing 87 people on board. A navigators group is charging that crews in the high-tech airplane found errors in equipment measuring height and distance from destination. Monday, a plane hit a mountain group in the German border just minutes before it was scheduled to land in Strasbourg. 9 people survived the crash. U.S. and North Korean officials met at the UN today in their highest-level meeting ever. They were expected to focus on U.S. concerns about North Korea's nuclear capability. NPR's Jim Zaroli reports.
Officials of the two governments met this morning at the U.S. mission to the United Nations. Neither side would speak to reporters as the meeting got underway, but they're expected to issue a joint communique later. The United States and North Korea have no official diplomatic relations, but have been holding talks in China since 1988. In announcing today's meeting, State Department officials said the two sides would be discussing a number of subjects, including the nuclear issue. U.S. officials have expressed concern for some time that North Korea might be embarking on a nuclear weapons program, something the North Korean government denies. Last month, North and South Korea signed a non-aggression pact banning nuclear weapons from the Korean Peninsula. In New York, this is Jim Zaroli reporting.
The Space Shuttle Discovery is now on the year's first U.S. space mission, carrying seven U.S. astronauts and a number of scientific experiments. NASA officials termed this morning's launch beautiful and a great way to start the new year. Liftoff was delayed for 1 hour, however, in part because of weather concerns. Scientific experiments will be checked to see how weightlessness and space radiation affect growth. Landing is scheduled next Wednesday. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. During the height of perestroika at the Moscow Book Fair, the American publishing company Knopf picked up a collection of short stories by the Russian writer Tatiana Tolstoya. She's the great-grandniece of Leo Tolstoy. That book, On the Golden Porch, was published here 3 years ago. Now Knopf has published a collection of Tolstoy's short stories, written prior to the disintegration of the Soviet Union. Our book critic John Leonard has a review of the new book, Sleepwalker in a Fog.
A couple of years ago, I said we should stop comparing Tatiana Tolstoya to Chekhov and start thinking about other Russian writers with more of a taste for the extravagant, like Bulgakov and Mandelstam, and maybe Andrei Bely from the Silver Age. Well, here she is again, Leo Tolstoy's great-grandniece, with another collection of stories. And in almost every review I've seen, they're still talking about Chekhov, and it's silly. Gogol, maybe, with his addiction to the fantastic. And Nabokov, who liked to levitate. In this country, Bernard Malamud, whose heart flew out of his mouth. In Latin America, any one of the magical realists. But Tolstoya is some kind of firebird, a Sufi dervish dancing on a language jet stream, up, up and away from the crowded communal apartments, the locked rooms, foolish dreams, forgotten loves, lost chances, and missed connections of the Soviet quotidian. Of course these stories are political. One man with special privileges in the party hierarchy imagines he is an angel, untouchable. Another, brain-damaged, wants to be a writer, but the only word he can scrawl is night. A third, contemplating the land masses on his office globe, disbelieves Australia and decides to abolish the erroneous continent. A fourth, a poet, cohabits with a young African woman, hoping to sire a new Pushkin. A governess from pre-revolutionary days dies forgotten, like liberal values, like childhood itself. A survivor of the gulag tells a casual lie about an innocent stranger, and everyone chooses to believe him, because it's easier than facing the truth about themselves. A loveless teacher of geography dreams, as we are told, of the very bottom of the heavy round earth, where the blue string bag of the meridians tightens into a stiff knot, and a frost-covered skier slowly wanders upside down among the delicate ice glades of Queen Maud Land. But in each story, mind itself is landlocked in a drab geography of bad poets, party hacks, the three spare parts of Marxism, and the 17 reasons for gradual transformation. A delusional system where everybody runs in place, like the three sisters on six legs who never got to Moscow. A never-never land where owning two cows locates you in what is called dangerous proximity to Kulak circles, and people even steal your curtains. Language, exuberant and surreal, is the only agency of levitation available to these characters to get out of the drab. By acrobatics of the word, they escape into alternative geographies from which they look down on Burma and Bombay, on the Vatican and Rome and gondolas in Venice, on a prince of Cambodia and an emperor of Japan, on New Guinea, Antarctica, and all the way to Africa, where we're told the equator curved like a morning rainbow melting in the sky. Everything's possible, says one character. Why not? Everything's exotic over there. But here, nothing but nothing at all ever happens anywhere, anytime, anyhow. But something did happen after Tolstoy wrote these splendid stories. as if by magic, at what she calls the fairy tale restaurant, all of Russia levitated into the air and vertigo.
John Leonard is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed Sleepwalker in a Fog, new stories by Tatiana Tolstoya. This is Fresh Air. Imagine a stage production of Camille with the Greta Garbo role played by a man in drag. That's one of the productions that established actor Charles Ludlam and his ridiculous theatrical company. The company, based in Manhattan, is best known for comedic, gender-bending reinterpretations of classic theater and film. When Charles Ludlam died of AIDS in 1987, his fans feared they had lost not only a great actor, but a wonderful company. But the company has continued under the leadership of Everett Quinton, who had performed with the company since the mid-70s and had been Ludlam's lover for as long. After playing many of the roles Ludlam had originated, Quinton started adapting his own material, such as The Hunchback of Notre Dame and A Tale of Two Cities. Next month, the company will have a 25th anniversary gala. I asked Quinton if taking over the company was a difficult decision and if he had ever discussed the possibility with Ludlam.
Actually, we were being interviewed on National Public Radio a number of years ago, and the question came up that if anything happened to Charles, could the company continue? And because Charles was in the room, we all said, well, no. And nobody considered that he would die, so it was not even an issue that anything you had really needed to take issue with. And then when we got home that night, we talked about it further, and Charles wanted to know why it couldn't go on if something happened to him. And then the usual reasons that he was so great, and he was. And then I said, well, I didn't think that I could direct it, and he said that he thought I could. And so far it's working. So I'm a little happy with that.
Well, you not only took over the company, but you also started appearing in more of the leading roles. Was it hard for you at the beginning to perform in roles that Charles Ludlam had originated?
Well, not in the smaller roles or the other roles that he didn't get so famous for. They were just kind of fair game. But then when I did Camille, at first in the rehearsal, see, I had seen Charles do it a lot because I was in it. And I knew exactly what he did, and I knew what his jokes were. And then when I started to rehearse it, I started almost to imitate him. And Eureka, an actress and director in the group, was the assistant director on this. And I got a little scared, and I said, well, I feel like I'm imitating him, and I feel like I'm afraid of that. And she encouraged me to just proceed. And she said that I would emerge somehow. And then it started to happen. And then I started to feel the imitating drop away. Because Charles and I are two totally different actors. And
You're physically very different, too.
Yeah, uh-huh. And I felt myself emerging as Marguerite Gautier. And then suddenly it just became a play. And then I had my job as an actor, and then I just had to accomplish the creation, and that was that.
Have you always loved old movies?
Yeah, that was my kind of escape. When I was a kid, we didn't have much, but we had our television, and me and my sister used to stay up all night sometimes, like on the weekends and things. And I grew up in the 50s, and you'd have all those great movies on the Late Show and the Late Late Show, and they would go on into the night, and we would just get our little TV guide and go to town.
Were there certain movies you were most obsessive about that you'd want to watch over and over?
Well, you know, when I was a kid, we used to have the Million Dollar Movie.
Yes, I grew up in New York, too. They showed the same movie over and over,
like
all week.
15, 16 times a week, and the great one that we watched was The Thing from Another World.
Oh, yeah.
Did you ever see that?
Many times.
It was so fabulous. That was great. And Caged, which was the great movie with all the great stars. Eleanor Parker was the little prisoner, and Hope Emerson was the evil warden, the matron, and Agnes Moorehead was the warden. Oh, it was so fabulous. And Jan Sterling was the prostitute. Oh, it was so great.
Let me ask you, you met Charles Ludlam in 1975.
Yeah.
You became lovers and joined the Ridiculous Theatrical Company. Had you acted before?
I was in a production of Rip Van Winkle when I was in the Cub Scouts.
So what, yeah, go ahead.
I was about to become an actor. I was in school, and I knew I was taking all this theater, these theater classes.
Uh-huh.
And it's hard to say where I would have gone. I mean, I feel certain I would have done something theatrical. I was heading in that direction. I just got really lucky.
So what was it like for you when you first started acting in the company?
It was liberating. It was an exciting thing for me. See, I knew I was queer when I was a kid. Like all queers know it. We know it, and it's nothing that mommy or daddy does to you. You don't get dropped on your head and get abused and become queer. You're born that way. And I wish some people would just get it into their heads and get over it so they could get on with living. See, and my trouble, see, I never had a problem myself being gay. The thing that frightened me was people's reactions and their power to do you harm. That's what bugged me. It was not my own. So, and I knew when I was a kid that I was this little drag queen and very happy to be that in my own soul. But it was terrifying. And then that's another issue, because even in the gay community, there's a discrimination there. But everybody's got to look down on someone. But then I got into the group, and it liberated me. It moved me. It shifted my thinking to see this.
So you said that you had been a drag queen for years, that you knew you were, but did you dress in drag in public? Or
no, I mean, once on Halloween I did, and I would wrap my towels around me in the shower. But see, then I thought I was nuts. See, that's my other, I'm getting to this point. See, I wrap myself in my towel in my bathroom, and it was so hidden, and I always thought I was crazy until I got into this group, and suddenly I wasn't nuts anymore. Suddenly I had found my place, and suddenly I was able to do whatever I wanted. And that's what we get in the group. Because we don't just do drag. That's not our total purpose. I play men and I play women. And I get to create characters, and it's totally liberating not to be locked into anything.
Have your parents ever come to see you perform?
No, they're both dead.
Oh, I see.
They died in the 70s. So I have to live that through my friends' parents.
Right.
So when they come, I get all nervous when the composer's mother and grandmother come. And so...
Did your parents know that you were gay or that you were a drag queen?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. My father was sick when we were doing the Ringot for Blunget, and he was in the hospital, and I played Flosshilda, the Rhine Maiden, and Ninny, the evil dwarf, in that. And I didn't get mentioned, but my name was listed in the you know how the Times lists the whole cast?
Yeah.
And my name was there, and he was real happy that I was in this play. And
that's nice.
Yeah, yeah, so.
Do you have any young actors coming into the company who remind you of yourself when you first started?
Not like me, no, but in courage, in the sense of, you know, like I remember when I was a kid, I didn't kind of really know what I was doing, but I did it anyway, and like you come in and you have talent and you've got guts, and that's it. And then you get molded, and then over time you develop your bag of tricks. So you see these people with talent and you see them with courage. Because it's like one of the most frightening things in the world, at least for me, is to step from backstage onto the stage. It's like one of the most terrifying moments when you're just about to do it for the first time. And it happens to me every night, even after all this time. It's like you want to be dead. And in that respect, we had one actor, we have Jimmy Lamb, who's this real good-looking guy, very beautiful, and he was waiting to go on in Big Hotel. And then I'm standing there watching him. I was going on right after him. And I'm standing there, and I'm thinking, even the great beauties are reduced to quivering flesh before they step onto the stage. And it's so, you know, that in that respect, does that answer the question?
Absolutely. No. Absolutely. Everett Quinton, thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
Everett Quinton is the director of the Ridiculous Theatrical Company in New York, which is celebrating its 25th anniversary. He's currently starring in Bluebeard and The Bells. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Well, we'll hear what the Congressional Budget Office said on Capitol Hill today about their outlook for the economy this year. Also, news of the conference in Washington on aid to the former republics of the Soviet Union. We'll also talk to some people who work for institutions that have that S word, Soviet, in their names and figure out what they're doing about their names. And a piece on a basketball heckler, a man with a season's pass to all of the Washington Bullets games, sits behind the visiting team's bench and yells his lungs out from start to finish. What he says and what the home and opposing players think of him.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. After the new year, rock and roll historian Ed Ward began a survey of what was happening in rock and roll 10, 20, 30, and 40 years ago. We've been through 1952, 62, and 72, and here comes 1982. New wave was in full swing, and a new microchip technology was producing instruments and sounds, not to mention a far more sophisticated way of sequencing drum beats, that were finding their way onto the charts and onto a new musical outlet, MTV.
'82 was one of those perfect years for pop music. Like 1957, 1966, and 1978, there were more good records around than anybody could possibly keep track of, but it sure was fun trying. It was a year in which the black and white scenes crossed effortlessly, when it looked like the revolution that punk had started was finally going to conquer popular culture, and in which optimism seemed to be the right attitude to take. The biggest revolutionary force in the land was MTV. After a shaky start, it began to get picked up by plenty of cable television networks, and the result was amazing. You were working as a waitress in a cocktail bar when I met you. I picked you out, I shook you up, and turned you around, turned you into someone new. Now 5 years later on, you've got the world at your feet. Success has been so easy. Records like the Human League's Don't You Want Me Baby would probably have been club hits no matter what, but MTV went online at a time when no U.S. record label had a video department and almost no U.S. acts were making videos. The result was that plenty of British acts like the Human League, who'd been making videos for several years for programs like the BBC's Top of the Pops, had high-quality videos ready for MTV play. And when teenagers in the hinterlands got a glimpse of them, these records took off. In fact, the electronic sound was hot everywhere, thanks to a former South Bronx gang leader's affection for a bit pilfered from Kraftwerk's Trans Europe Express. Yeah. Afrika Bambaataa and Soul Sonic Force led the next generation of rappers, and Planet Rock was such a hit that I even heard a high school band in Central Texas playing it. Bambaataa's strategy was to unite the worlds of rap, graffiti painting, and the downtown scene in New York into a single underground cultural force, and his personality was such that I'm still amazed he never ran for president. Rap's previous generation was still going strong, though, and made one of 1982's most powerful records.
Can't take the noise, got no money to move out, I guess I got no choice. Rats in the front room, roaches in the back, junkies in the alley with the baseball bat. I tried to get away, but I couldn't get far, cause a man with a tow truck repossessed my car. Don't push me, cause I'm close to the edge. I'm trying not to lose my head. It's like a jungle sometimes, it makes me wonder how I keep from going under.
The message summed up tensions in America's cities all too well and proved that Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five still had what it took, although some of the language in the song kept it off of many radio stations. The world of disco and rock was fusing, rap and electronics, and Britain's Soft Cell summed everything up in what is still one of the best-selling singles of all time.
Sometimes I feel I've got to run away, I've got to get away from the pain you drive into the heart of me. The love we share seems to go nowhere, and I've lost my light, for I toss and turn, I can't sleep at night. Once I ran to you, now I'll run from you. This tainted love you've given, I give you all a boy could give you. Take my tears, and that's not nearly all tainted love.
Why, even The Clash, the last of the original great punk bands, had a hit. Didn't sound much like them, but it was a hit. 1982 was also the year of Moon Unit Zappa's Valley Girl, as well as the mind-numbing Vangelis rendition of the theme from Chariots of Fire, and of Urban Cowboy, the death knell of country music. For some reason, Hall & Oates were everywhere, but it didn't really matter. Great things seemed to be in store, and going to the record shop hadn't been so much fun in years.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, the Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll, and he writes for the Austin Chronicle. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Audrey Voblitis and Thad Kirk. Chris Burgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, redesigning America's public schools. We talk with Ted Sizer, the head of a coalition that works with high schools in putting theories of education reform into practice. He's also the author of several books about school reform. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.